Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Mester, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Sam, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. This is a program sponsored by the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. It's Update on Lymphoma from the 2013 American Society of Hematology ASH Annual Meeting. Now, this is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care and a number of other cancer-related organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call over 805 participants, so this is a very large call. A lot of you are very interested in this meeting, all the information you're going to get on today's call. And we have from all over the United States, we have participants from all over this country and all different regions. And we also have international participants from Australia, Brazil, Canada, Ireland, Taiwan, Thailand, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a bit of a global call. And I really want to acknowledge the fact that you are clearly a group of people who want information, and you've joined us to get as much information as you can about what's new in lymphoma. Now, today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Celgene Corporation, Genentech Biooncology, Biogen IDEC, Seattle Genetics, and Spectrum Pharmaceuticals. And I really want to thank the Lymphoma Foundation and all of our corporate sponsors for today's program and their collaboration in making this program possible. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all of the materials you received from Cancer Care, and those materials is information about our speakers, the topics they'll be addressing. There also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource to each of you. These are free resources for you to contact and utilize. And there is an evaluation form. And I'm going to ask all of you at the end of today's program to please complete that evaluation form. Hands down, you are the most important people to tell us what topics and programs we should be offering. And so if you would kindly do so at the end of the program and just send them back to us, your evaluations, they will really help us as we plan our programs for 2014. Indeed, this program has become almost like an institution because many of you have asked us to do this program over and over again, and so we continue to offer it, and your feedback really justifies our doing it because it tells us that you want us to offer these programs. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. John Leonard. And Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Associate Dean for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Medical College, Vice Chairman of Medicine for Clinical Research, Associate Director, Cancer Center, Chief Lymphoma Service, Attending Physician, New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Lennon is going to address an overview of lymphoma, new research presented at ASH, and the important role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Leonard.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I always enjoy the opportunity to participate in these sessions, and it's very nice to hear from patients and family members how helpful this can be. So thank you to all of the organizers. In the next few minutes, I have a big task, so I'll try to be efficient about it, and I'm sure we'll come back to some issues during the question session. So I'm sure that most people know that lymphoma is a tumor of the lymph tissue, and the crucial thing in lymphoma is what type of lymphoma one is dealing with. The lymph cells are kind of like the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. There are many different types of cells that do different jobs as part of the immune system. And when the switches get broken that regulate their growth, one can get a lymphoma or a growth or a tumor of those lymph cells. And so because there are many types of cells, there can be many different types of lymphoma, and there are over 60 types of lymphoma, and many of them are different as far as their prognosis, as far as their treatment. And we have lots of new developments and new treatment options. We will touch on some of these in the call today. But I think the paramount thing for a patient with lymphoma who's trying to sort through what to expect out of their disease and what to do about it is to really have a good understanding of what type of lymphoma one is dealing with. And in some cases, lymphomas can change. And so sometimes repeating a biopsy to clarify this and having one's biopsies reviewed by an expert pathologist who focuses in lymphoma can be very useful. So the big categories of lymphoma fall into T-cell lymphomas and B-cell lymphomas. T-cell lymphomas commonly involve the lymph nodes, the skin, many of the key areas. There are also Hodgkin lymphomas. And that's one category of lymphomas that are typically treated with chemotherapy, most commonly a regimen called ABVD. And there are a number of new treatments there we'll come back to. Sometimes those patients receive radiation as well, and stem cell transplants and other types of therapy as part of their treatment. And then the big categories of B-cell lymphomas, which are much more common, include follicular lymphoma. This is the most common of the indolent or chronic lymphomas. A related type of lymphoma, at least on how we approach it, is something called small lymphocytic lymphoma, or SLL. Also, CLL is a related type of lymphoma that tends to involve the blood. So follicular lymphoma, CLL, SLL, and sometimes a type called marginal zone lymphoma. Those tend to fall in the indolent or chronic lymphomas. These are lymphomas that people tend to manage over many, many years and often get treated with a variety of different treatments over time, and there are a large number of different options to treat an indolent lymphoma. Another category is called mantle cell lymphoma. That accounts for about 10% of lymphomas. It is also treated in a variety of different ways, ranging from chemotherapy with an antibody treatment called rituximab. Sometimes people get treated with stem cell transplants, and there are a variety of new options, some of which we'll come back to in a few minutes. So there are a number of different options for mantle cell lymphoma, and a variety of ways which clinicians and patients approach the disease, because there's some variability in the different possibilities. And then finally, about a third of patients have what we term aggressive lymphoma. The most common of those is called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. That is most typically treated with a regimen of chemoimmunotherapy called R-CHOP, which is sometimes used for other types of lymphoma as well. Aggressive lymphomas can be cured with chemotherapy, so that's one of the scenarios where often we can treat the disease and it goes away and doesn't come back, although if it comes back, it can be more challenging to treat and sometimes need more aggressive treatment. So there's a wide range of lymphomas, and we can't possibly nail down all of this in a great detail in a call of this length. But I would just like to emphasize that it's really important for a patient to understand exactly which of these many types one is dealing with, because the approach and the expectations can be very different. And obviously, as you're comparing stories and notes or read about a particular new treatment, the exact treatment or the exact situation one is dealing with is really essential to understand. So I'm going to give you kind of some rapid-fire thoughts and comments on some of the new data that were presented at the American Society of Hematology. There are every year we have more than a convention, more like a scientific meeting where the latest data are presented. This is over 10,000 people. It happened to be in New Orleans just over the past weekend. And so there were presentations across all of the spectrum of blood disorders, blood clotting, leukemia, lymphoma, myeloma, and other areas. And so it's really kind of more or less everybody was there who works in this area, partly to learn and partly to present our latest research findings. So I'm going to just touch on a couple of things, and I'm sure we'll come back to others in the question session. So one of the big areas of interest relates to kind of standard therapies, and there were a couple of presentations that were there that I think result or relate to many of the people. One thing that comes up often in the treatment of patients with particularly indolent lymphomas, follicular lymphoma most commonly, is the role of maintenance rituximab. And so one of the studies that was updated is a study called the PRIMA study. And this is a study that took patients who with follicular lymphoma who received chemotherapy with rituximab, most commonly R-CHOP, and then randomized them to 2 years of maintenance rituximab versus observation. And now with 6 years of follow-up, we have some evidence that the findings are maintained, that there's about a 12% difference in the number of people that are in remission at an average of about 6 years later. So about half of the patients were in remission when you look 6 years later versus about 60%. So for about 12% of patients, that 2 years of maintenance rituximab made a difference as to whether or not they're in remission. So you can look at this, and I look at this in my practice as kind of a glass half full, glass half empty. For some people, you will be in remission. You're more likely to be in remission if you take the maintenance rituximab for 2 years. For other people, and most people, it didn't make a big difference. And in fact, you can often retreat people if their disease comes back with rituximab at the time that it's needed. So this, I think, is something that gives us more follow-up on this approach. I think there's still some debate in the field, particularly because the overall survival, meaning are people still alive 6 years later and beyond, and that doesn't seem to be changed. So the fact of the matter is that, again, maintenance rituximab has benefit to keeping somewhere around 15% of people in remission longer. But for the rest of the group, it doesn't make a big difference, and the overall survival is about the same. So you could consider it. You could not consider it. I think it's an important thing for people to keep up with and discuss with their doctors. A second area that I think is important is that there was a variation of this theme. Patients receiving rituximab alone, randomly assigned to essentially 1 year of rituximab in a modified maintenance form versus 5 years of rituximab. And the bottom line there is that the maintenance kept people in remission longer, the overall survival was quite the same, and the toxicity was pretty manageable. So I think the message on maintenance rituximab is it will keep some people in remission longer, but it does not seem to keep people alive longer. And in many cases, one can choose to do the maintenance. Some people might choose not to do the maintenance and just do a retreatment with rituximab when it's needed. So again, talk about that with your doctor. That what I just cited relates to follicular lymphoma primarily, although maintenance rituximab is sometimes used in other areas as well. There was a randomized trial comparing maintenance rituximab after chemotherapy in follicular lymphoma versus a drug called ibritumumab tioxetan. It's a radio-labeled antibody also called Zevalin. So the question was maintenance rituximab versus Zevalin radioimmunotherapy in patients in remission after getting treatment for follicular lymphoma. And the bottom line of that study was that the results were quite comparable. So the radioactive antibody Zevalin did not seem to improve things versus rituximab alone. So they were all both reasonable approaches. And so, again, you can look at that as glass half full. You can look at that as glass half empty because there was no difference. And I think, again, this question of do you do a maintenance or do you do the radioactive antibody after chemotherapy, I think there are lots of options there. There aren't clear differences as far as how people do in the long term. And I think one should discuss that with one's doctor and decide if you should consider nothing or if you should do the maintenance rituximab or the radioactive antibody. But in the end, at the end of the day, as far as survival, are you alive years later, it seems to be quite comparable. Next, I want to move toward, and this is kind of rapid fire. I'm sure we'll come back to some of this later in the questions. There were studies presented focusing on lenalidomide. Lenalidomide is a drug that is approved in relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. It's a pill. Our group at Cornell presented some data looking at lenalidomide with rituximab as initial treatment. There are several studies that have looked at this in follicular lymphoma. We looked at it in mantle cell lymphoma, and there's some data looking at it in combination with the R-CHOP regimen in both follicular and large cell lymphoma. So lenalidomide, which is approved in myeloma, it's approved in mantle cell lymphoma, may have a role either alone, in combination with rituximab, or in combination with chemotherapy in a variety of different lymphoma settings. None of these trials were randomized trials, so we don't know how they it compares from one to another, but these are interesting data that one should think about, and I think lenalidomide is an option that continues to be studied in a variety of different lymphoma settings. I want to mention a drug called brentuximab vedotin. This is an antibody against something called CD30. CD30 is a target that is on Hodgkin lymphoma cells and some T-cell lymphomas. We saw data presented with this drug. It's an antibody-drug conjugate, or ADC. This has high activity in relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma patients, high activity in certain T-cell lymphoma patients, and is being studied in a variety of different settings, either alone or in combination with chemotherapy, and we saw updates on some data with this approach. I want to mention an area called CAR T-cell therapy. This is a type of immunotherapy that many people ask about. It's gotten a lot of attention. Some of the first studies were done down at the University of Pennsylvania. This is essentially taking one's own T-cells and essentially arming them to better activate the immune system and then injecting the T-cells back into the patient to go after and activate the immune system to better fight lymphoma cells. This was first studied. It got a lot of attention on the news and the newspapers in certain types of leukemia. It's been studied in B-cell lymphomas. It's been studied in in CLL in particular. So this is a new approach. Several centers are also looking at this. I think as we gain more experience with this, we see that it seems to work in certain types of disease as far as getting remissions. However, I would caution that there's still a lot of work going on trying to figure out how long this lasts. In some patients, this can be quite durable. In other patients, the disease can go into remission but relapse before too long. And so this is something that people are interested in. I think the jury is still out as to how long this will work, what percentage of people it works in, who should be targeted toward this therapy or other therapies, but it's something of interest, and I think people should continue to pay attention to, although it's really something that's limited to clinical trials at this point. And then finally, I just want to mention two types of therapy. These are called kinase inhibitors. One of these is called idelalisib. It's what's called a PI3 kinase inhibitor, and I know these names I'm going through kind of quickly. This is active in patients with CLL. It's also active in patients with mantle cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma. My colleague, Dr. Richard Furman, presented data in one of the major sessions, a trial in CLL patients that had receiving idelalisib plus rituximab versus rituximab alone, showing that the response rates were much higher in the combination, the time in remission was higher in the combination, and in fact the overall survival, were you alive months to years later, was improved with the combination of these two drugs, again, idelalisib, the PI3 kinase inhibitor, versus rituximab alone. So this is something that will continue to be studied in CLL and in other lymphoma subtypes, including follicular lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma. And then finally, there is a drug called ibrutinib. This is an inhibitor of what's called a kinase or a switch called BTK. And this drug is also a pill. It has been studied and is now FDA approved in mantle cell lymphoma in patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, and it's been studied and clearly seems to be of interest in patients with CLL or chronic lymphocytic leukemia as well as in follicular lymphoma. So ibrutinib is another drug that's out there, FDA approved in mantle cell lymphoma, being studied in other lymphoma subtypes. It's being combined with a number of other treatments, and this is a very interesting new drug that is coming onto the scene as well. And I'll just conclude by saying that all of what I've talked about, all of this new information that unfortunately had to kind of go through rapid fire, is the result of participation in clinical trials. And really, any time a patient needs to be treated, one should ask one's physician or explore whether or not a clinical trial is an option. This is how we advance the field, how we develop new treatments, and how today many patients can access many of the new treatments that are out there in clinical trials that, as I've mentioned, seem very, very promising and hopefully are going to continue to move things forward to improve outcomes for patients. So with that, I'll stop. I know we'll come back to many of these issues later in the discussion, but I'll turn it back over to Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Leonard, for a most informative, overview of the conference, the symposium, and also for all the information that you've shared. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Owen O'Connor. Dr. O'Connor is Professor of Medicine and Experimental Therapeutics, Director, Center for Lymphoid Malignancies, Department of Medicine. He's co-director, Program of Lymphoid Development and Malignancies, the Herbert Irving Comprehensive Cancer Center, Columbia University Medical Center, the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. O'Connor is going to address disease-specific treatment updates, communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns, and managing treatment side effects and discomfort. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you to the Cancer Care and to the Lymphoma Research Foundation for continuing to put on what I believe is a very important educational activity to help patients meander through the tons of information and opportunities that are now emerging for patients with various kinds of lymphoma. What I'm going to do is just talk about two general areas. One will be on how we're now beginning to use many of the new drugs that you just heard about to try to change the standards of care. And then we'll talk a little bit about how many of these new drugs are being used as single agents to try and help patients who have disease that has relapsed or come back after conventional therapy. And one of the drugs that I want to talk about first in terms of a study that was presented by Umberto Vitolo and the Italians actually looked at combining a drug you just heard about called lenalidomide with standard chemotherapy called R-CHOP in patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. As you just heard, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is the most common form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it tends to be a relatively aggressive form of lymphoma for which the standard of care is R-CHOP-based chemotherapy. Well, one of the things we've learned over the last several years is that when you look at patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, we know that some are going to do well and others may do less well, but it's very hard by looking under the microscope to figure out who's going to do well and who's not going to do well. But a lot of really interesting recent data has emerged, which has given us some molecular tools to be able to categorize patients into having different kinds of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We call it the cell of origin. And patients you may have seen or read can have large cell lymphoma derived from what's referred to as the germinal center, or can have large cell lymphoma derived from what's called the post-germinal center. And we know that those patients who have large cell lymphoma derived from the post-germinal center tend to have a more challenging time with conventional chemotherapy, meaning that the standard chemotherapies we use are better at curing patients who have large cell lymphoma derived from the germinal center. And so a lot of the big breakthroughs, at least from my point of view, over the last couple of years have come from the realization that many of these drugs, and I'm going to talk about two of them, one lenalidomide and the other is ibrutinib, seem to be able to overcome the challenging prognostic features of that post-germinal center form of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So lenalidomide is a drug for which there's now some data to suggest that when you use it by itself, it may actually have more selective activity in the more challenging prognostic group of large cell lymphoma, those post-germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphomas. And so the Mayo Clinic group has actually done a study where they looked at combining lenalidomide with R-CHOP chemotherapy, and they reported last year at ASH some pretty provocative results that suggested that in a very elderly patient population, they were able to get the overwhelming majority of patients, nearly 100%, into complete remission, with many of those actually being many patients having some form of response, with many of them being complete remissions. And in fact, that similar study design had been validated by the Italians in a presentation they did, where they presented a study with lenalidomide integrated into R-CHOP-based chemotherapy. And again, they showed that they could attain complete remissions in more than 80% of these patients. And what appears to be true, both from the Mayo Clinic study as well as from this Italian study, is that the patients who seem to derive the greatest benefit are those that actually need that benefit. So the more challenging form of the disease, those ABC or post-germinal center diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, seem to have an equivalent, if not better, response to the lenalidomide integration into the R-CHOP-based chemotherapy. And I think this is a very, very, very important observation, because in our ability to try to cure everybody with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, obviously we will go a long way if we can develop therapies that help those patients that have some of the more challenging forms of the disease. So the data from the Italians and the data from the Mayo Clinic are now leading to a dialogue to conduct and very large international study looking at a randomized study of lenalidomide R-CHOP. It's actually called R-squared because the other name for lenalidomide is Revlimid. So R-squared CHOP against the standard of care, R-CHOP, is actually being conducted in order to formally determine the merits of integrating lenalidomide into that therapy. And I think that's something to look for. And for those patients with newly diagnosed aggressive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I would, in particular, try to look for clinical trials that are exploring those opportunities. In a similar vein, our good friend Dr. Anas Younes from Memorial has presented a study with a drug called ibrutinib. And as you just heard, ibrutinib is a very powerful drug that actually inhibits some of the pathways that drive the misbehavior of lymphoma cells. And ibrutinib has been approved in mantle cell lymphoma, and there are a number of studies that will hopefully lead to its approval across a wide variety of different lymphomas. But Dr. Younes looked at integrating ibrutinib into a R-CHOP-based chemotherapy regimen for precisely the same reason. It looks like ibrutinib seems to have near selective activity in that poor prognostic subgroup of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, those post-germinal center large cell lymphomas. And so in a strategy to try to really improve the cure rate of the disease, Dr. Younes has conducted a early phase clinical study looking at the safety of building ibrutinib into R-CHOP-based chemotherapy. And in the study that he reported at ASH, the overall response rate was nearly, again, 100%, with approximately 75% of those patients having complete remission. So we're going to need to see how these new drugs will affect the paradigms of care for most patients. But many of us in the field are very excited that these kinds of studies, integrating very rational drugs that directly address the molecular basis of these diseases into conventional upfront treatment programs for many of these lymphomas, could change the standard of care and could change the natural history, improving how we actually take care of patients and improving how they actually do with chemotherapy. So the other category to talk about are some of those newer drugs, and talk about them in studies where they have been explored as single agents. And you heard about one of those called idelalisib, which is a PI3 kinase inhibitor. And we've learned over the years that this PI3 kinase plays a really pivotal role in transducing or translating signals from outside the cell that drive lymphoma cells to grow to messages inside the cell telling the cell to grow when it shouldn't and not die when it's supposed to. And the PI3 kinase inhibitor, idelalisib, has emerged as one of those drugs with very promising activity across a whole variety of different non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And Ajay Gopal from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center actually performed a study, a phase 2 study of the PI3 kinase inhibitor, idelalisib, in patients with indolent forms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But he actually explored it in patients that we call double refractory. He explored it in patients who had seen prior rituximab and had seen prior alkylating agents, drugs like cyclophosphamide, which are part of CHOP and CVP, and bendamustine, which is an alkylating agent. And we know in the field that patients who have double refractory forms of indolent lymphoma tend to have more challenging diseases because there aren't that many drugs that work in that particular setting. So they sought to answer the question, does idelalisib work in this more challenging population of patients? And lo and behold, when they did the study looking at patients with follicular lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma, marginal zone lymphoma, as well as lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma and Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, they found that nearly 60% of the patients had a response to therapy. The majority of those responses, though, were actually partial remissions. Few patients actually attained a complete remission of their therapy. But what they did find among the patients who responded is that it was a very durable response. For many of those patients, it lasted well over a year. And what was interesting, albeit the numbers are a little bit small, is that patients with Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, sort of an unusual form of lymphoma that exists somewhere between lymphoma and myeloma, seem to have a very high response rate. And we know from Irene Gobrial up at the Dana-Farber that this is a disease that seems to have really profound sensitivity to these PI3 kinase inhibitors. So I think that's a very promising new drug. Another new drug that's tries to hit something that we know has been important for a long time, and in fact our group has done a lot of work trying to develop drugs that target how cells die. We call that apoptosis. And there's a very exciting new drug called ABT-199. And there were data presented last year that suggested that this particular drug, which lowers the threshold required to produce death in the tumor cell, that it was very active in some forms of mantle cell lymphoma and follicular lymphoma. And in fact, John Seymour had presented an update of his results looking at this ABT-199 in patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia and small lymphocytic lymphoma. And again, he had actually demonstrated in patients that have disease that has been very heavily treated with conventional therapies, the overall response rate is about 80%. But what was really provocative about his results is that we know in some forms of CLL that there are certain molecular types of the disease, one we call deletion 17P. And this happens to be a really, really bad and challenging form of CLL. And what John reported was that the response rate in all types of CLL and small lymphocytic lymphoma, as well as the response rate in this very, very challenging molecular subset of the disease, was identical. So he basically demonstrated that this small molecule, ABT-199, was actually very active in the disease, irrespective of how much chemo you had, and irrespective of those known adverse molecular markers of disease we know to be difficult to treat. And I think that is a very, very promising development, and I can foresee that what's going to happen now over the next couple of years is that drugs like ABT will be integrated, just as I described with lenalidomide and ibrutinib, into conventional standards of care in order to try to lower the threshold to reduce or lower the threshold required to produce cell death from various chemo regimens. The last drug I'm going to talk about is also emblematic, I think, of where much of medical oncology is going. And it actually looked at a new drug called crizotinib in patients with ALK-positive forms of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. ALK is actually a kind of kinase. It stands for anaplastic large cell kinase. And it's pretty important in some kinds of T-cell lymphoma. And it actually turns out now it may be expressed in other forms of aggressive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. But there's a specific genetic event that happens in some of these T-cell lymphomas where this ALK kinase gets markedly dysregulated, and it's really one of the hallmark features of the disease. And now we've actually begun to develop drugs that selectively and specifically target those unique molecular events that define how those diseases misbehave. And crizotinib, in fact, is what we call an ALK kinase inhibitor. And so it should theoretically work in those diseases that carry that particular molecular event. And while this is a very small study, the early results are simply astounding. What they did is they actually looked at all patients that had this ALK mutation or this ALK genetic event, and they gave them crizotinib. And they treated 11 patients, but of the 10 patients they treated who had very heavily treated disease, 91% or 10 of the 11 patients actually attained a complete remission. Only one of the patients had a partial remission, and that remission with that drug, as long as the patients took it, seemed to have very, very durable remissions. So now what I think we're going to see is that we're going to be able to look at these diseases biologically and try to figure out who should get what therapy. And if you carry some of those genetic events that describe your disease, I can foresee us taking some of these new drugs off the shelf and trying to figure out how to integrate them into your disease. And these kinds of results are really exciting in terms of our ability to change the natural history of these diseases without being totally dependent upon the often nonspecific and cytotoxic effects of traditional chemotherapy. Our group also reported some interesting studies using epigenetic therapy, using drugs like azacitidine and decitabine and drugs like romidepsin to alter and affect the malignant gene expression profile of different T-cell lymphomas. And we actually presented some studies looking at combinations of these epigenetic therapies in very aggressive forms of T-cell lymphoma, showing that not only were combinations of these drugs highly synergistic in killing T-cell lymphoma, but they were able to reverse the malignant gene expression profile of those diseases away from the standard gene expression seen in the malignant cells. So I think it's all part and parcel of where a lot of new therapies are going. Integral to whether you're getting new drugs or you're getting combinations of conventional chemotherapy, I think it's really critical that every patient have an open and a transparent dialogue with their healthcare team. And central to that, of course, are the nurses. We hear all the time that patients who call the nurses and actually share with them how they're feeling and complaints about side effects and complaints about the therapy, oftentimes the nurses can intervene in a proactive and preventive way to try to minimize many of those side effects. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is for every patient to have an open dialogue with their healthcare team and to not be abashed or shy or ashamed about asking about certain side effects. It's really very important that when you have these side effects that we intervene early. And that is essential to managing the side effects. There's no such thing as a perfectly safe drug. There's no such thing as any drug that has no side effects. While I think many of these newer drugs will have less side effects and less toxicity compared to the conventional, every drug is going to have some form of toxicity. And I think the forms of toxicity we're seeing are probably a lot less, but whatever the side effect that you see, it is imperative that you have an open discussion with your physician and your healthcare management team so that we can intervene as early as possible. And sometimes many of those side effects come down to patients not drinking enough, patients not eating well, and many times there are simple little supportive medications and other little services that can be provided by the healthcare team to help minimize those side effects. So it's really critical that you have that open dialogue with your team so as to preempt the unwarranted and unnecessary side effects of care. With that, I'll end and turn it back to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Connor, for a very comprehensive presentation and also for concluding with the importance of really everyone really getting state-of-the-art care, but also in terms of their careful management of any side effects that they may have and discussing with the healthcare team, the entire team. It's really important, so thank you. And our next speaker is Megan Gutierrez, and Megan is Chief Program and Policy and Communications Officer, Lymphoma Research Foundation. And Ms. Gutierrez is going to address the free support programs, services, and conferences offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And I just want to say that it's been a pleasure working with Megan Gutierrez and the Lymphoma Research Foundation in making today's program possible. It would not have been possible without the support and the guidance of Ms. Gutierrez and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. So now I'm going to turn this program over to Ms. Gutierrez.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and to Cancer Care for our continued partnership. I would also like to thank our esteemed faculty, Drs. Leonard and O'Connor, for taking the time to be with us today and for all that they do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by lymphoma. I would also like to acknowledge Celgene Corporation, Genentech Biooncology, Biogen IDEC, Seattle Genetics, and Spectrum Pharmaceuticals for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. To date, the Lymphoma Research Foundation has funded more than $54 million in lymphoma-specific research, and more than 60,000 people are served each year by Lymphoma Research Foundation programs and services. The foundation provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for people dealing with a lymphoma diagnosis and their caregivers. These include the Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional staff can assist you in your search for information, resources, and other support, a Clinical Trials Information Service, which can assist you in your search for a clinical trial, our Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had a similar lymphoma-related experience. We also offer print and web-based publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, and informational e-newsletters. Lymphoma.org, LRF's website, provides information on a wide variety of education and support topics. I'd encourage you to visit us online. From the website, you can also find webcasts and podcasts, which are available on specific types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support topics. You can also link directly to LRF's YouTube channel, where we have a number of video interviews with experts in the field of lymphoma that are very informative. The Lymphoma Research Foundation also offers in-person patient education conferences on the local, regional, and national level. You can identify upcoming conferences on our website. And last but not least, I'd like to encourage everyone on today's call to explore our new mobile application, Focus on Lymphoma. Focus on Lymphoma is the first mobile app for smartphones and tablets that provides patients and caregivers comprehensive content based upon their lymphoma subtype and tools to help manage their diagnosis and treatment. The app allows you to record doctor sessions, manage medications, keep track of blood work results, and document treatment side effects. For more information on any of these materials or the resources offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation, please contact us at 1-800-500-9976 or visit our website. Again, that's www.lymphoma.org. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Megan, for just a wonderful presentation and also for the work of the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And if anyone on the call has not made contact with the Lymphoma Research Foundation, I would encourage you to really contact them. They're just a wonderful resource for all of you. And our next presenter is Sarah Kelly, and Sarah is an oncology social worker, and she is a coordinator of our older adult services at Cancer Care. And Ms. Kelly is going to address the free psychosocial support services and groups offered by Cancer Care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'd like to thank everyone on the call. I think we got some amazing information today. So as Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people coping with lymphoma and also their loved ones. And I really want to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. I think there are a lot of ways we can help. Just a little bit about Cancer Care. We are a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, which we provide face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally. We have support groups, which we also provide face-to-face in New York and over the phone nationally and also online nationally. We provide education about resources, practical help, and how to navigate the healthcare system. We also provide some limited financial assistance as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All our services are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers, and they are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her support network and family and friends. They're also trained to help cancer patients and their families and loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, financial demands, physical changes due to diagnosis and treatment, social adjustment and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis are an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family and support network. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. And, you know, I really cannot stress that enough. You don't have to walk this path alone. In joining a support group, you really can connect with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. With individual counseling, you have a space that's just yours to voice any concerns that are coming up. And I feel these connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer and their loved ones experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis. If you're interested in any of the services that I've talked about, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-HOPE. That's 1-800-813-4673. And I also recommend you visit our website, which is www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you'll find a lot of additional information on there about your diagnosis, coping with diagnosis, and also all of the support services we provide. You know, I think we learned a lot from today's program. There's a lot of information to digest and get our arms around. Social workers really can help you understand what it means for you. We can help you prioritize, and if you need to, you know, talk to your medical team or you're concerned about questions to bring up, and I know Dr. O'Connor talked about that, which is great because it's so important to be able to have those conversations with your medical team. We can help you with that, too. Just remember, again, that you're not alone in this, and that's really the main thing I'd like for you to take home when I talk about support in our services. You don't have to be alone in it. You know, we're here to help you. Thanks for your attention and the opportunity to talk. I'll turn it back to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you very much, Sarah. That was a wonderful presentation, and really, again, letting everyone know about all these services that are available so that you don't have to cope with this alone. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions, so I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board, and then if Sam will explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Now, if we do not get to your question, and I'll repeat this again at the end, please call either the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care, and we have staff available to answer your questions. And I'll give you all those numbers and everything so you'll have them, but let's go for the questions first. Sam?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking on the Ask a Question button. Our first question comes from Ron R. Your line is now open.
Hi, my question has to do in reference to what I think was called the PRIMA study, where after initial treatment was 2 additional years of rituximab or compared to no additional years. It almost seems like there should be data collected at the same time for 4 years out, or maybe continuous from the initial treatment all through to all 6 years. Does that data exist at this point in time?
Excellent. Thank you for that excellent question. Dr. Lennon, would you like to address that question?
Sure. So what the caller is referring to is basically, again, the study in follicular lymphoma for patients who had received chemotherapy with rituximab and responded to it, meaning their tumor shrunk. And most of these patients on the study had received R-CHOP. Some of them had received R-CVP. And patients in this study were randomly assigned to either get 2 years of maintenance rituximab or observation. And the study showed now with about 6 years of follow-up, in the ballpark of about a 15% difference between the two groups. So out of 100 people, it made a difference for 15 people. And for the rest, it didn't seem, at least at this point, to keep them in remission any longer. So, you know, when one designs one of these studies, one has to kind of make compromises. And being part of one of the large national groups that designs such studies, there are lots and lots of different opinions. Some people say, let's give maintenance rituximab for 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, indefinitely. There are lots of ways to do it. And, you know, one needs to kind of compromise and develop some consensus. And so this study happened to have been designed for 2 years versus observation, and I think other studies, one that I alluded to, looked at essentially 1 year versus 5 years. at the end of the day, I think that there are lots of ways to look at this. I think some people would argue that maintenance rituximab is a good thing because people stay in remission longer. On the other hand, other people look at this and say, well, it's not necessarily such an important thing because you can always do rituximab if your disease comes back. And if you don't live any longer, you're taking a therapy that requires going to the doctor every 2 to 3 months, depending on the schedule that you use. That's an expensive therapy, and that it really is something that, you know, perhaps we should do studies that look at other issues that could perhaps even have a greater impact. So I think at the end of the day, one has to get a study done that one can answer a question that can be useful for the community, but one also has to prioritize what are the most important questions. And I think from my perspective, you know, it's the PRIMA study has been useful, but I think at the end of the day, if we're going to really make a huge impact for people with follicular lymphoma, the time that one is on maintenance rituximab, if one is using it, probably, at least in my mind, is not going to be the crucial issue that's going to make a long-term difference for most people. It's probably going to be how do we use some of these other new drugs that we've talked about that can work in different ways and potentially have a greater long-term impact for patients.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next question, please, Sam.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Larry A. Your line is now opened.
For a patient with follicular lymphoma, if there is a transformation, does that lymphoma become diffuse large cell B lymphoma? And the second related question to that, is there any treatment alternatives besides CHOP for someone who's already had CHOP in case of that transformation?
Thank you. Excellent questions. Dr. O'Connor, would you address these questions in a general way? And, of course, we'll recommend our caller go back to the treating healthcare team, but if you could address this for him.
Sure. So most patients who have follicular lymphoma or other forms of indolent lymphoma probably carry a lifetime risk of transformation of anywhere between 50 and 70 plus percent. So if you live long enough with the disease, there's certainly a reasonable probability that you could experience transformation of the disease. By histologic transformation, what we mean is that what was formerly a slow-growing, indolent form of disease now becomes aggressive. Theoretically, what happens is that those tumor cells acquire additional mutations that affect how the cell grows and how that cell dies, and typically that transformation is to diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. When that happens, what one typically does is follow those paradigms of care that are used for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and that involves use of a anthracycline-containing regimen. So for those people that can tolerate an anthracycline-containing regimen, and the drug that I'm specifically referring to is doxorubicin, that's probably the most important drug for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and probably one of the most important drugs for patients who experience a transformation. So for those patients who don't have any pre-existing cardiac complications or issues that would preclude use of the anthracycline, the recommendation would be to receive an anthracycline-containing regimen for that first episode of transformed lymphoma. For those patients who relapse after receiving a anthracycline for their transformed lymphoma, you would again try to follow the paradigms of care that are used for managing diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and that would involve the use of some form of induction chemotherapy. Commonly that might be ICE chemotherapy or R-ICE chemotherapy, depending upon how long it's been since your last rituximab, followed by an autologous stem cell transplant. And in some fraction of cases, that can be a curative regimen. Now, there is another drug that's very, very active in this particular setting, and those are the radioimmunotherapy drugs, one in particular called Zevalin. And these are basically monoclonal antibodies to which a radioisotope has been conjugated, and the concept is that the monoclonal antibody, like Rituxan, brings that radioisotope in close proximity to the disease. There are a number of specific criteria somebody needs to meet before they can get those drugs. But that drug as a single agent has pretty marked activity in the disease. And there are other trials that are looking at the integration of drugs like Zevalin into the transplant regimen, in regimens called Z-Beam, for example. So if you have a transformation and you're a candidate for an anthracycline, the recommendation would be that you should get that anthracycline. There's some probability you can be cured of the transformed lymphoma. You may not be cured of the indolent disease, but the paramount goal is to actually cure you of that aggressive lymphoma, which, if not cured, can represent a threat to your life.
Thank you. Excellent. And, our next question comes from Jessica. It's an online question. Are there any studies underway looking at the effects of lifestyle and or lifestyle changes, including diet and exercise, on the faulty expression of genes that underlie the development of lymphoma? Dr. Leonard, could you address that question?
So there are a number of different studies in various types of cancer that have tried to associate certain lifestyle sorts of changes, whether that be diet, whether that be exercise, or other sorts of activities or exposures. And while this has occurred in a large number of different cancers, these studies, they've been less well established in lymphoma. And part of that is because lymphomas are less common. It's when you look at and when you start to think about one type of lymphoma where a certain factor may make a difference and another type of lymphoma where a certain factor may not make a difference, you really get into relatively smaller numbers of patients. And in fact, you know, many of our interventions are things that would have to be done in parallel with treatment if we're talking about a change in lifestyle that would impact how somebody does once they already have a diagnosis. There are some studies that have attempted to look at these sorts of things in large populations of people, i.e. you look at a group of people who happen to have developed lymphoma and try to understand what factors their lifestyle could have impacted years in the past, and whether or not that had a relation to whether or not they developed lymphoma. The bottom line and my take on this is that I think this is likely to be a somewhat important issue. It is something that is relatively harder to study, particularly in lymphoma. And I would say it's probably, while it seems intuitively important, if we have a group of patients with lymphoma, there are probably bigger questions we need to ask, i.e. which of these different medicines can make a difference in somebody who already has lymphoma. And it's hard because, you know, the relative number of people with lymphoma compared to the entire population is smaller. It's really hard to answer these questions. So I tend to extrapolate really what we would do in other cancers, and I think that for patients who want to either individuals who want to avoid getting lymphoma or who have lymphoma and want to do better and want to try to keep it from coming back or to live longer with their lymphoma, I think the common sense approach is to use a healthy diet, to exercise, and really all of the sorts of common sense things that we all know as far as nutrition and exercise. And I think they are probably even more important. They're important for everyone, but they're probably even more important for patients with lymphoma. And I think I would try to do my best to maintain those factors, because there are lots of connections between particularly obesity and various forms of cancer, and it certainly wouldn't surprise me to learn that they may influence lymphoma as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Excellent. And our next question, Sam?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Patrick R. Your line is now opened.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yes, Patrick, yes, your question.
Hi, Dr. O'Connor had mentioned briefly about epigenetic therapy and drugs, I believe, particularly, I think you mentioned a few drugs very quickly and possibly in combinations that they're highly synergistic. I wonder just real briefly if you could mention those drugs again.
Sure. So there are two classes, and when you talk about epigenetic drugs, you're talking about drugs that can influence the genes that are turned on or transcribed from the DNA. And actually, one of the very first of those drugs approved was one that I worked on years ago called vorinostat, which eventually was approved for the treatment of patients with skin lymphomas, CTCL. But the two classes that we're talking about are referred to as histone deacetylase inhibitors, and that includes drugs like romidepsin, which has been approved for T-cell lymphoma, vorinostat, which has been approved for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, and there's another one now that's pending before the FDA called belinostat, which has activity in peripheral T-cell lymphoma. So the HDAC inhibitors represent one arm of this epigenetic group of drugs that we're talking about. And the other arm is represented by what are referred to as hypomethylating drugs. And it turns out that one of the major mechanisms by which cancer cells turn off the good genes is by methylating those genes and putting little chemical groups on the gene, and that actually silences the gene, and that's the way cancer cells happen to manage the balance of having bad genes turned on and good genes turned off. And so these hypomethylating drugs, there are two classes, azacitidine and decitabine. They're essentially the same drug. These drugs are very important in removing those methyl groups and allowing the good genes to be re-expressed. And there have been studies looking at these combinations in a disease called myelodysplastic syndrome. And now there's an evolving experience in lymphoma, and in particular T-cell lymphoma, where we know the HDAC inhibitors have been approved and have very potent single-agent activity. There's a lot of interest in trying to look at how to optimize the use of these drugs to complement treatments for both B and T-cell lymphoma.
I would just emphasize that some of this work has been done in the laboratory, and Dr. O'Connor has done much of that. Our group has been interested as well, but in fact we presented some data of such a combination in patients where unfortunately what happened in the laboratory, at least so far, hasn't translated to the patient. Now that may be a variety of factors, and I think we're all very interested in this approach, but I would highly emphasize that this is really something of a great deal of interest in clinical trials, but should not be done in practice, generally speaking, at this point in time, because we're still sorting through many of the details of this, and it's possible that people could have more side effects by combinations, and that's why we're studying these to really sort through the best way to do it, and as you heard, in what patients can potentially benefit the most.
And this is one of those contexts where you should only receive those therapies on a clinical trial. And, you know, we're one center that has trials looking at those combinations. There are others around the country. But, again, as you just heard, it's very early. It's a lot of supportive data, but it's something that needs to be done under close scrutiny by people who have a lot of experience in the area.
Excellent. Oh, this is really this has been a remarkable call. I want to thank our speakers. All of our speakers have been just extraordinary. Dr. Leonard, Dr. O'Connor, Ms. Gutierrez, Ms. Kelly, just extraordinary call. And I also want to thank all of you who've asked such great questions, both online and on the telephone. And I also want to thank those who've been listening or who didn't get to ask a question. So I do want to first of all say, if you have a question, didn't get to ask it, I'm going to give you two numbers that you can call. They're in your materials. So one number is the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and you can call their 800 number, 1-800-500-9976. Or you can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And that information is in all of your materials. Most importantly, in planning a program like this, we recognize this one-hour program and that we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one hour, so that we want you to know that you are now linked to major organizations, Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and many other organizations as well, for help and support. We don't want anyone to leave this call feeling that you are alone. Often when you have cancer, you do feel alone, and particularly at this time of year, around the holidays, people feel sometimes more alone, more isolated. And we want you to know that you're now part of this supportive community of all these organizations, and we want to be here for you. We're simply a telephone call away. We all have websites as well, whatever is most comfortable for you. But we have people that you can actually talk to and ask questions to. And there is no question that you can't ask. And as our speakers also said during the call as well, the same is true for your healthcare team. So I want to really thank all of you for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine time of the year at this time of year, but I also want you to take advantage of all of these support services so that you can get on your way and enjoy this time of year as well with your family and friends, and also using our support groups and all of our programs to make you feel better and more helped. So thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's workshop. You may all disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.